And welcome. I'm Dr. Mona Kular, and this is To Immunity and Beyond. I'm a medically trained doctor and nutrition and health coach, and I love helping people find the very best version of themselves. This show is all about living well, feeling well, and most importantly, aging well. The immune system is essentially the body's wellness system, so by understanding and supporting it, we can all reach an optimal level of health. I'll be having conversations with a wide range of experts from around the world on all the areas that can support our immune system to help us live healthier for longer. Let's live life better. Eric, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really grateful to have you on and really looking forward to this chat with you.
Me too. I'm glad to be here. You know, I lived in the UK for almost 10 years, so it's kind of nice to, even if I can't visit, I can visit, you know, in presence.
So Eric, we're going to be talking about, actually, you have such a varied and interesting background. I'd love to talk to you for hours about all of it, but we need to focus on the important bits for today. So we're going to be talking about health, wellness, immunity, your program WildFit. And I thought a good place to start was if you could give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself and specifically how you came to set up WildFit, which is a health transformation program.
Yeah, I think it, like many of these things, it started with a very personal journey. And that was that as a child, I was pretty unwell on a regular basis. Everything from innocuous allergies to quite serious digestive disorders and headaches and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And of course, my parents, being concerned for me, sent me to a variety of, sent me to our family doctor and then to specialists. And they prescribed a variety of different drugs and injections and creams and pills and even surgery to try to solve all my problems. And nothing ever did. And then I just got inspired one day to start thinking a little bit differently about food. Some friends of mine sat me down and had a conversation with me about food. I made some changes. And 30 days later, I'd lost 35 pounds, which is what, 2 stone. All of my allergies are gone. My mother didn't recognize me picking me up at the airport. I had changed so physically. And that started a big journey for me because, of course, many of my friends started asking me what I had done and because they wanted to create the same results. And so that first of all propelled me down this, like, let's call it researching nutrition, like really trying to understand nutrition. And as a GP, you're going to appreciate what happened to me here. But I went to one of my doctors and I asked, like, there was a surgery I no longer needed, and they were trying to convince me to still have the surgery. And I'm like, I don't need it anymore. And it was what you might think of as a very minor surgery, the average person, it was a tonsillectomy. But when you're 21 years old and a fully matured man with integrated tonsils, it's not a minor surgery anymore. People die during that surgery. It's, you know, I didn't want to have it anymore. And they're trying to convince me. And at one point, in a moment of, I don't know what you'd call it, just rebellion, I asked one of my doctors how long they'd been to medical school, and they said 6 years. And then I asked how much of that time was spent studying nutrition. And I expected the answer to be small, like, oh, a week. But I was shocked by the answer. And the answer was none, literally none. And I even as a kid of 21 years old, this blew my mind. And so I thought, well, if they're not going to study food, I'd better do it. And so I at that point started a real, like, interest in food itself. But that wasn't enough, it turned out, because I would have friends come to me. I had a friend of mine came to me, saw what changed in my body. He wanted to do it. He was very overweight. He was able to stick to the rules with willpower for a few weeks. He lost some weight, but then boom, relapse. And he just couldn't stick with it. And I was like, why? What was the issue? And that's where I started diving into what we might now call food psychology, understanding why we eat, when we eat, how much we eat, and so forth. And that's what gave birth to WildFit. The world did not need another diet. In fact, the world doesn't need any diets. In fact, no, that's not true. Humans need a diet. It's called the human diet. They need that one. But they don't need to go on some temporary alteration to their normal eating pattern so they can fit into some special outfit for a special occasion. They need a lifestyle revision. And that's where delving into the food psychology is what made the difference. When our clients go through our program, 3 years later, they're still on track. And that's the magic.
Yeah. I just love your whole philosophy and ethos around this, which is, you know, why I wanted to talk to you. And it's so true what you say, that traditionally trained doctors don't have any formal training on nutrition. If you know anything, it's usually what you've gleaned yourself along the way, or if you have your own personal interest. And It takes a while, I think, though, until you realize how important it is. Or sometimes it's your own personal health issue that makes you realize the importance of health. And certainly with myself, I found that I didn't connect food and health for a very long time, actually, even as when I worked as a doctor. And now I look back and think about all the people I'd like to go back to and talk to again and give them different advice. So just going back in your own journey, so you're in your 20s, and this is around the time then when you started changing things for yourself in terms of food and then looking into food psychology, and you obviously found this made a huge difference to you. Did you change other things in your life at the same time as well, or was it just the food that you sort of focused on at that time?
You know, what's interesting is, you know, there's this big thing about doing ice baths and cold showers and stuff at the moment, which I recommend. And we can talk about all the physiological reasons for doing that, pushing blood deep into the body and then having it rush to the surface and all the different possible benefits of doing that. But I'll tell you, the single biggest reason for doing it is that in a very real sense, the way our psychology works is we have our higher self and we have our body. And our higher self can take over at times, but the body ultimately can rebel. So, for example, you and I could both hold our breath right now. We could have a competition. We could hold our breath. I'll bet you, looking at you, you're in pretty good shape. I'll bet you can get out over a minute. But there's going to be a point at about 90 seconds, probably, where your body is going to take over and make you breathe. And your body is so committed to that it will do it even if you are in a room full of smoke or underwater, for that matter. The body will take over. And so when we look at this journey around food behavior, what's really fascinating is, well, going back to the cold shower, is when somebody forces their body into the cold shower, it's very much like disciplining the crew. It's like the captain disciplining the crew of the ship. You will scrub the deck. You will stand in the storm and you will put up with the cold. And what ends up happening, the more people do stuff like that, is they start to gain greater command over themselves. And here's where the magic of that is. Every single one of us has had the experience of, oh, I should do this, or I shouldn't do that. Or they, like, even this example, a married couple having an argument and one of them goes dark. And it often happens, right? They both go there, but one starts it sometimes. One goes dark and starts saying really terrible stuff. But you ask that person, man or woman, if there was a voice in the back of their head going, why are you saying this stuff to somebody that you love so much, right? Like, there's this other identity back there. And that identity is the higher self. And when you get good at letting the higher self be in charge and not listening to the body all the time, then you get command. What's fascinating is that when somebody gains what we call food freedom, when they gain the ability to not eat that stuff that they wish they wouldn't eat, and not with willpower, they actually gain a higher degree of sovereignty over all of their behaviors. It's a very powerful thing.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's such a salient point that you've made. It's not just to do with food, although obviously that's very important, but so many of us now are very out of tune with that higher self or that intuition, that sort of inner voice or whatever it is. And actually that can be so useful in guiding us in so much in life, whether it's making a big decision, choosing a partner, the right job, all of those types of things. You also need to be able to tune in and hear that voice, hear that higher self and understand and listen to it. But we're sort of so distracted these days and so busy and fast paced that we just sort of bat it away and carry on regardless. And that comes down to food as well.
Yeah, it definitely does. Look, when I've been known to say the odd vaguely controversial thing about COVID, and I'm not some big conspiracy theorist or what have you, but I watched, in a very real sense, I watched the COVID pandemic begin in the United Kingdom in 1997. And what I mean by that is that I arrived in the United Kingdom in 1997, and having come from America, Canada, and the United States, where I spent most of my time, what I noticed is that the British people were substantially thinner than their American and Canadian counterparts, substantially. But over the next 10 years that I lived in the UK, I watched the UK population double in size. And I'm not talking about the number of people. I'm talking about waistbands. I'm talking about putting on weight. I watched TGI Fridays, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, and these places. Sorry if any of them are your sponsors, but I imagine they're not, since we're talking about health. But the fact is that I watched all those restaurant chains open up around America. I watched Coca-Cola come flooding in, and all of a sudden the population, and by the way, what we're very clear about now with any attack on us from a pathogen perspective, but particularly COVID, is that obesity and diabetes are a major problem. And so in a very real sense, the devastation of COVID really started back then When these terrible food policies and terrible food qualities came in and people started losing track of their health. And the problem was, is that they couldn't see it because it happened to them slowly.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you say that. I've just finished an editing show, actually, with a bariatric surgeon who's written a book called Why We Eat Too Much. I don't know if you've heard of it.
And no, it sounds great.
Yeah. And he essentially, you know, wanted to dive deeper into the psychology behind why are people getting so obese, but then why are they coming to him for such a drastic measure as bariatric surgery? So he wanted to sort of unpick it all. And, you know, he dove all into the metabolism, you know, he broke everything down. And he said himself, obesity is the pandemic we should be worrying about. And I think when you frame it that way, you know, it makes it so much more powerful, and we need to do that to get people to sit up and take notice, because otherwise it's just a very insidious disease that's spreading without anyone realizing. As you say, it's so gradual, and it's so easily facilitated by these huge organizations and corporations that, you know, sadly are very powerful themselves. So it's a tricky one for sure.
It really is. Unfortunately, and I'm generally a fan of capitalism, but I recognize that capitalism is just, you know, it's just the best form of all the bad ways of running an economy. You know, there are definitely big weaknesses with it. And one of the big weaknesses is that companies aren't necessarily evil, but they are profit driven and they're there to serve their shareholders. And so, you know, a food manufacturing company is going to take a look and go, well, how do we make more money? We make more money by driving our costs down, which is to say less nutrients. And we make more money by driving more sales, which is to say getting people to eat more food. And what better way to get them to eat more food than to make sure the food is nutritionally empty and full of addictive substances. And then we can use manipulative marketing campaigns to get them there. I mean, you know, we're in a place now where there are people that aren't even particularly Christian in their lives, but they feel like they can't celebrate Easter properly if there's not chocolate involved. And I went to an Anglican school, and so I've read the Bible a number of times, and I'm not a particularly religious person, but I will say that I know the nativity story. I remember how it went. I remember there was this questionable pregnancy, and then there was the birth in the manger, and then there were the sheep and all the stuff, and then the three wise men showed up. And the three wise men brought frankincense, myrrh, and gold. Not one of them brought chocolate or candy canes. But we've now gotten to the place where our holidays, our special occasions, and our emotions have all been sponsored by the food industry. We are now at a place where if you've had a bad day, you know that, well, chocolate can cure that. Or you're feeling lonely and depressed, well, ice cream can take care of that. They've conditioned us by marketing to what in marketing terms are called trigger emotions. And they know that if they can hit you at that trigger emotion, then you will not have a choice about what you buy. They want it that way. And we have to fight that, because that is the pandemic. That is what weakened the population enough for a virus like COVID-19 to be as devastating, in my opinion.
Yeah. And, you know, they're very clever. As you say, everything that they create hits those dopamine receptors and stimulates those pathways, and it becomes addictive. In the sense that we want that hit over and over, we want to feel that way. And like you said, it makes you feel better when you've had a bad day, or you're stressed, or just sometimes when you're bored. And it becomes a very vicious cycle that's hard to break out of.
Very much. Here's a really great example. When we, you know, and this is something that we developed in WildFit. I've not seen it anywhere else. I'm hoping it's other places, but we have something that we call a food timeline, and it works like this. Imagine somebody's having a triggering emotion, sadness, depression, loneliness. And they have a linkage in their heart that says, if I eat chocolate, it's going to fix that for me, right? Or ice cream or cake or cookie or whatever it is that their parents gave them when they skinned their knee when they fell. It doesn't matter how it got there. Here it is. So now they're feeling this negative emotion. And now they're going to eat the food, because the food, in theory, is going to help them to feel better. But here's the really crazy part. The really crazy part is that if you really check in with somebody and slow time down for them for a minute, what you'll find is that it's not eating the food that makes them feel better. It's the decision to eat the food that does that. So somebody is let's say you have minus 10 is deep depression and plus 10 is total joy and zero is neutral. Nobody likes being neutral. Neutral is numb. So now all of a sudden somebody's feeling a minus 5. They're feeling sad and depressed, minus 5. Now, they know that ice cream can lift them up, but the kicker is it's not the ice cream that lifts them up. It's the rebellion or the considerate or the treat. And so the minute they go, oh, I'm going to have an ice cream, they've already lifted to plus 3, which means that they've started producing serotonin, dopamine, feel good chemicals in their body. And here's the crazy part that people just don't seem to understand. In the same way that certain drugs can make food taste yummier than it really is, many people will have experienced in their, say, college days. The fact is that when we start producing all the serotonin and dopamine, everything seems better, which means that the ice cream ends up tasting better than it really is. And so we end up in this loop. And then lastly, you just said it very well, is that they're looking for that hit, right? But like anything, the more often you have it, the less power it has. So now, where it used to be like one scoop of ice cream could kind of get you there, pretty soon it's 1.5, and then it's 2, and then it's 3. And the portion sizes, like that's one of the other things I saw change in the UK over that 10 years. When I arrived there and I ordered at a restaurant, I'd be like, is this all the food you're giving me? By 10 years later, I'd go into a restaurant and go, oh my God, it's like an American food size plate. We need help.
Yeah. And all of that contributes to us becoming much more divorced from our own emotions and sensations, you know, hunger, the true sensation of hunger, the true sensation of thirst, the true sensation of fullness. We end up ignoring those because those other biological systems are overriding them. I feel like we could talk about this for ages, but we need to talk about other things too. So I just wanted to go back a little bit in your history. You spent quite a lot of time with the Hadza tribe over a period of 10 or 11 years, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm really interested in that because they've obviously been studied very extensively and we hear so much about them. And I understand that their own lifestyle has probably changed a little bit over time as well, but I'm just interested to know, you know, when you first of all, when that was, when you first sort of came across them and how that came about and what struck you at the time and any changes that you saw over the years that you spent with them.
It's been really fascinating. I think the first thing we should say is we should not overly romanticize the Hadza as any perfect example of, say, our history. We can't say that their lifestyle is, say, a direct match for our ancestral lifestyle. But I think it is fair to say that their lifestyle is the closest representation currently on Earth that we have to that ancestral lifestyle, I imagine. And, my history with them actually dates to before I even knew what they were or who they were. And that was that my great grandfather discovered a skull, and it was at the time, the oldest Homo sapiens skull in history. So at 12 years old, I'm in the National Museum in South Africa, in Bloemfontein, and I'm holding a cast of this skull and has two bite marks in the top. And the bite marks are about the right size for a leopard or a hyena. And I've spent a huge part of my life wondering what that guy's life was like. He was 259,000 years old. You know, like it makes the pyramids basically about the same age as the library down the street from you. You know, it's like that's a long time frame. And I've spent a lot of time wondering about that lifestyle. And so years ago, when I was living in the UK, actually, I used to run a leadership program where I would take people up Kilimanjaro as part of a mental toughness training and leadership training and so on. And the logistics team that I was working with in Africa did some Googling of me or what have you. And they found out that I was really interested in anthropology and human history and what have you, and took me both to Olduvai Gorge, which is maybe the most significant paleoanthropological site on the world. And then only a stone's throw away from that to go visit with the Hadza people for the first time. And it was amazing. Again, I don't want to romanticize it, but it is a romantic thing. I mean, it is like getting a time machine. It does feel like that. And all of a sudden, we're with some people that don't have homes. They're nomadic. They don't grow food of any kind. They are pure hunter-gatherers. And it has been one of the great privileges of my life over the last 10 years to spend a lot of time with them. I was just with them a few months ago again. And you're right. We can talk about some of the things that we observe that have influenced the way we work with our clients around the world. But I also want to talk about how things have changed for them, because even in the 10 years, in the same way that I watched the UK change over 10 years, I've been watching the Hadza change for the last 10 years. And here's one of the problems. Misguided missionaries with big hearts and wanting to do good things are showing up there and trying to impose Western ideals upon them. And in particular, in this context, I was just there recently and I watched a missionary hand the Hadza people a bag of refined flour, another bag of vegetable oil, and another bag of sugar. And they on some level, they think that they're helping or doing them a favor. Well, I can tell you something. The same thing was done in Northern Canada when Europeans arrived. The same thing was done. In fact, the guy who invented or discovered and patented exogenous insulin for diabetics wrote a report, or actually didn't even write a report, commented to a member of the press, and it got picked up. He thought he was off the record, and basically said that the rampant disease that he was seeing in the First Nations people in Canada, the original Canadians, he said was that devastation was being caused by Western food, by white flour, by sugar, by alcohol, and so on. And the same thing is happening right there at the Hadza. And, the last 2 years that I've been visiting them, is the first time I've ever seen an overweight Hadza person.
Wow.
Yeah. And that, guess what? This one particular woman went to go live with the missionaries for a couple of years. She's easily 80 pounds overweight. I've never seen anything like that with the Hadza. They are the leanest, meanest, fittest people I've ever seen. Until we start influencing them.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with ZeroZilchZip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit ZeroZilchZip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
The station that makes you feel good.
So when do you think this first happened? Over the time that you've supposed to spend time with them, is it very recent, or is it going back?
I think it's a miracle that it hasn't, that their lifestyle hasn't been obliterated already. Frankly, that's the miracle. Yeah, yeah. I think that's been gradually happening to them for a long time. And you know what's really interesting? I find this fascinating. So we live in the safest times in the history of Earth. Like, one simple way to look at it is I'm 51 years old. If I was born in 1900, by now I would have already gone through World War I, the Spanish flu, which infected one third of everybody on Earth, World War II, the Great Depression, the Cuban Missile. I mean, that was a tough generation to be in. We were born, the toughest thing we've had to go on is you're going to have to sit on your couch for a couple of years and not try. Yeah. I'm not saying it's been easy. I'm just saying it's been the easiest time to be alive. And yet, guess what? Suicide rates are going up, 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 up. You know what else is funny about that? And we're going to come back to the Hadza on this in a minute. There was a psychiatrist, I think, who wrote a book called Suicide and predicted in late 1800s that major global conflict would actually cause suicide rates to go down. And guess what? World War I and World War II suicide rates went down and only slowly crept up again after the war, because the war created a common sense of community, and community is the best thing to fight suicide. Now here's what's really crazy about this. The Hadza people, when I was with the chief, not the last time, but the time before, I was talking to the chief. His name is, the best representative we have is Nona. I can't say it the way they say it. It's like, they have these clicks in their language. It's so cool. But I asked him if the Hadza people have suicide, and they didn't have a word for that. So we had to explain the concept. And we said, out in the rest of the world, occasionally people end their own lives. The look on his face was so amazing. Like, what? And the guy behind him, who was sleeping on animal skin in the back of the cave, the guy behind him heard the translation, sat up and belly laughed, like laughed. Now, this is not a funny thing, but to them, the idea that somebody would end their own life is insane. The idea that it would even, it wasn't
like, why would you do that?
Exactly. Now, here's the thing. They are the happiest people I've ever seen. And it's not like I spent an afternoon with them. I have lived with them for days on end over the space of 10 years. Like, they are the happiest people I've ever seen. And here's what's really crazy. We think that all of our technological advancement and all this stuff is making things better. But the truth is, it really isn't. The human suffering is going up as life gets easier. In the old days, I would write a letter to my mother from boarding school. It would take me an hour to write it. It would take her 2 weeks for the post to deliver it to her. She would then read it and think about it. She would carefully write back to me. And that was the pace of communication. Now we quickly send off an SMS message without thinking about our emotions, and now at work, we're getting email when we're not even at the office anymore. All these things were meant to make our lives easier, and they've consistently made our lives harder. And you know what's crazy? If you were to take us, say 40,000 years ago, and suddenly beam us to now, we would rebel. We would not accept this life. We would want the life of personal liberty and freedom. We would take the risks of nature over what we're dealing with today. But we don't think that we would because, you know, it happens slowly. And a neat example of this is with the Hadza. Every now and again, the government comes along or the missionaries come along and convince the Hadza, you should try civilization. Yeah, it's so much better. And so they're like, well, what does it mean? And they're like, well, you don't have to hunt anymore and you don't have to gather because you'll have free food here at the mission. So they show up, but free food's very enticing. They get there and there's free food. But then the free food, you know, now you have to listen to their discussion about God and the lifestyle that you're supposed to live. And then you got to clean these dishes over here. And now we're expecting you to do a little bit of work over there and so on and so forth, right? Well, hold on a second now. They then realize that the cost of the free food is just too much. And they go back to the wilderness because the jump is too big. The jump for our ancestors was very small. First, they were hunter-gatherers. Then maybe slowly they started noticing that when they finished eating something, they threw the seeds over their shoulder and look, plants are growing. But this is something that would take generations.
Yeah. Do you know, it's so insightful what you've just said about, because I totally agree with that. I often think if you were to flash forward, you know, from where you were and look at a snapshot of life, would you want it? And I think the answer would be, as you've just said, no. You know, stress levels are high. Mental health issues are high. People aren't really happy. They're not connected. They're not satisfied or fulfilled. They're more unhealthy than ever. And actually, it's not a good way to be. But because it has happened so gradually, there was no point at which anyone thought, hang on, what's happening here? It just, a bit like the COVID pandemic and all the restrictions that came in, you know, everything was drip fed very slowly. So by the time you're asked to stay at home and only leave your house once a day, it feels normal because it's all happened so gradually along the way.
That's exactly it. It was like the frog in the hot water. It happened slowly, gradually, and here we are. And there's a concept that we talk about in the wildfit community called the evolution gap. And that the gap is that our pace of change genetically is very, very slow. And, you know, it takes multiple generations to fully change a species, right? But ideas can move within a generation. And so those ideas began to stimulate changes that our genetics couldn't keep up with. And I'll give you a really great example. This is the evolution gap applies to all areas of life, but here's one of the most tangible ones where I first saw it. I knocked out one of my teeth. And, you know, I had to put another tooth in. And I noticed something about that. If I slept at night without the denture in, my teeth would start to close in on it, right? Okay, this is interesting. Then it raises another question for me about my doctor telling me I have to have my wisdom teeth out. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, is this some manufactured profit-seeking surgery from the medical industry? Like, why would God or evolution, whatever your belief system, put these teeth in that we don't need? Why would that happen? Well, here's what's crazy. Even today, in the safest times ever, you go around and ask all the people around you, and I'll bet you'll find that somewhere between one-fifth and one-third of the people you know are missing a tooth from the front of their mouth from some trauma. And we live in the safest times ever. So you have to imagine 3 generations ago, it was half the people, and 10 generations ago, everybody was losing a tooth at some point in their lifetime. Wisdom teeth are spare teeth. That's what they are. They're meant as spares because you knock the one tooth out, and if you don't put the denture in, then the teeth re-space, and then there is space for your wisdom teeth. The problem we have is that we put the denture in and now there's nowhere for the wisdom teeth to go. Incidentally, here's what's crazy. About one third of people never grow wisdom teeth. And isn't that fascinating? And on top of that, of the people who do grow them, some only grow one, some grow two, some grow three, some grow four, some grow five and six. It's not this fixed idea that people get four. Yeah. And here's another crazy statistic about this. Men are twice as likely to suffer a facial trauma and lose a tooth as women, and men are twice as likely to grow wisdom teeth. Now, why am I saying all this? Because I believe that wisdom teeth is an epigenetic response to trauma. If you are not punched in the face, if you don't take a football to the face, if you don't take a hockey puck to the face, if you're not in a car accident by the time you're a certain age, you don't grow wisdom teeth. But if you do suffer that trauma, then that triggers your body to produce your spare teeth. And where the evolution gap comes in is that we have technologically, for the last 100 or so years, been putting a denture in. The denture is what causes the problem. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't put the denture in, but now it justifies the surgery. And what I'm trying to say is that there are a million more things like that where technology is actually causing our sickness, our stress, our anxiety, our suffering. Life is much easier than it has ever been before, but in our bodies, it's actually harder than it's ever been before, which is why suicide rates are higher than they've ever been.
Yeah, that's so fascinating about the teeth. I feel like I need to go and research that and read a bit more about it.
Yeah, I stumbled upon a lot of that stuff working on this book that I'm working on about the evolution gap at the moment. And I'll give you one more example just so you get the pattern here. Cortisol. As a GP, yeah. I'm sure you understand the role of cortisol. And here's one of the things that most people don't know about cortisol is that one of cortisol's jobs is to tighten up your blood vessels in order to curtail bleeding. So, for example, if you trip and fall, you'll feel tingling in your body before you even hit the ground. And that's your body trying to stop you from bleeding excessively before you even hit the ground. Now, that's incredibly functional for a hunter-gatherer. That's a very useful thing. You know. But then the problem is that by tightening up all the blood vessels, now your blood flow isn't very good. So now you have to produce adrenaline to increase the power to the heart so the heart can pump the blood better. And you've got all this going on, which is, again, perfect if you are a hunter-gatherer facing a lion. But if you are a human being in 2021 facing a legal summons, not the least bit useful at all. You get the legal summons, you look at it, you start producing blood coagulating cortisol and adrenaline, and none of that is helpful in today's world. And that's why we are dealing with the stress, anxiety, suffering, depression, suicide that we are today, I think.
Yeah. And when you look at that example, you know, in its evolutionary stages, that cortisol and everything would then be dissipated by whatever happened next. So you'd end up in a situation where you're either fighting or you're running or something. And then that brings everything back to a level of homeostasis. The problem, as you say, is we look at this legal summons or whatever, then nothing happens. We're still just sitting there drinking our coffee, whatever else is going on. And those cortisol levels stay. There's nothing to just dissolve them away. So our lifestyle then compounds that problem.
Not only that, there's even not like quite aside from all those things that would help cleanse the cortisol and the adrenaline out, there's another style of breathing that can do it. And it's I've just been reading about this recently, but it's basically a double inhale sigh. It goes like this. And if you think about it, that's crying. Yeah. It's this pump, 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 and you flush it all out. And guess what? We're conditioned, particularly men, are conditioned that crying is not you. You cannot receive a legal summons and cry. That's just not acceptable behavior.
Even though you might feel that way.
You're not allowed to do it.
Oh, no, I love that. And actually, when I talk to a lot of my clients, I tell them to take exercise snacks through the day, because movement is a good way of dissolving that cortisol. So if they live sedentary lives or they have stressful jobs where they're sitting down all day and they've got things coming at them, I say, look, every 45 minutes to an hour, just get up, stretch, jump up and down on the spot, swing your arms around, whatever. It just helps to buffer that cortisol. Otherwise, it just keeps going up through the day.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you two things about the Hadza tribe that I thought of as you were talking. And the first is just out of interest, which is, how did you find it living with them, I mean, in a way that is so far removed from how you would have been used to living? And the second, as we were going to talk about anyway, is just, you know, then what principles or what sort of things did you observe when you were with them that you then took away to incorporate into your program with WildFit?
Yeah, sure. Well, the first time I visited with them, it was just for a day. And I went and visited with them for a day, and, you know, it was a very brief visit. We, you know, they taught us how to shoot the arrows, and, you know, basically it was almost like they actually do that type of thing for tourism now. But then as I got to know the family more and more, I started doing longer and longer stays. And so I've now done like a full week long embedded stay where I don't take food with me. And I take water because I'm not an idiot, but I don't take food with me. And I go there and live with them properly. And I did another one like that for 2 weeks. And so the first thing that you're struck by, at least that I'm struck by, is how intensely physically demanding and challenging their existence is. So in any event, as an example, the chief woke me up one morning and he goes, "Are you ready to go hunting?" And I'm like, "Yeah, of course I am." and I get ready to go hunting, and I grab a pedometer because I want to track where we go hunting, right? I want to know how far we go. So we go hunting, and we get back at the end of that day, and we've done 27 miles. Now, the last time I did 27 miles was the London Marathon, running around the streets of London for 26 miles. But now this is, and I remember when I ran the London Marathon, everybody's like, oh, you have to be so careful. The cobblestone streets will kill you. It's going to be so tough. No. I want to tell you that those cobblestone, I would have prayed for cobblestone streets. Like I'm trying to think, who was that big heavyweight boxer that was big back in 2000? I ran about 5 miles of the marathon with him, and we got to the cobblestone streets, and they were pretty tough. But I got to tell you, running through the bush with thorn trees that are actively trying to remove your eyes and gouging at your legs and cliffs and ups and downs and uneven ground. And it was 27 miles plus, it was 100 degrees outside, right? This is intense. And so we go hunting and we do that, and we don't have a very successful day hunting. It's not a very successful day. We get a couple of small things, not enough to sustain anybody. That night, you can imagine the physical condition I feel like I'm in, right? You know, I didn't train to do this marathon. It just happened to me spontaneously. Next morning, the chief comes up to me and he goes, are you ready to go hunting again? The next morning. And I'm like, okay. And off we go. Again, turn on the pedometer. Let's go. We do 17 more miles. And the only reason that we didn't do more than 17 is that we killed a bush pig, which is, say, 150 or 180 pound pig. And then we had to cut it up and carry it back to camp, which was a pretty serious undertaking. So we did 17 miles, but a big chunk of that was carrying heavy stuff back with us. This is in 2 days. The average human in the UK right now today will never do that distance in a week, let alone in 2 days. And this is normal for them. And so I was really struck by, first of all, how physically demanding and intensive their life is on a day-by-day basis. But secondly, how much they enjoy it. See, that's the deal, is that that isn't hard for them. They do it all the time. So it's not difficult. It's just what they do. By the way, the chief was mega impressed that I came with them the second day, because he didn't think, you know, we thin-skinned Europeans could handle stuff like that. And it's one of the reasons he and I have such a good relationship, because when I go with him, I go all out. I ask him to treat me like just like anybody else in the tribe. And that's where you really see it. It's a tough, tough life. So now to your second question about, what are some of the distinctions that we've learned from them? Well, it's kind of partly, to the second question, like some of the observations we made, here's a really interesting one. On my last trip with them, just this year, I was out hunting. I had taken a few friends of mine, one of the co-founders of Zumba, and Dr. Paul Saladino, and we went out to go like a very intimate trip, and it was really special. We went out for this long hunting trip, and usually when we go hunting, we have guides with us, and of course, as normally, we had guides with us, that way, if you kind of fall behind, because the bushmen move quickly, right? If you fall behind, it's no big deal. The guides have your back and, you know, whatever. So anyway, we got to this one point where we were hunting baboons, which is one of their favorite things to hunt, which is really quite a thing to see. It's more like warfare than hunting, frankly. And they managed to get one. And so everybody was stopped at this one riverbank with the baboon, the carcass, and they were going to go get more. And so they were doing that. And I then walked down into the riverbed, and the chief went running by, and he goes, Mzungu, 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 which means basically tourist. And he's running and he's pointing, you know, it's like, and I'm like, shit, okay. And I run because I think he's telling me to run. And I run with him. And I, like about half an hour later, I am like running full speed through the bush in Africa. And I realize I don't have any of the guides with me. I have no idea how to get back to where we stopped with the other group. I am on my own in the middle of the bush with the bushmen. And we get to this place where the baboons are up on this big hilltop, and the chief looks at me and he smiles and he points at one of the dogs and he says in his language, I don't know much of it, but I understood what he said. He said, his name is Mzungu, and he's pointing at one of the dogs. He was never shouting at me to run with him. He was shouting at the dog to go. And I misunderstood and started running with him. And here I am in the middle of Africa because of a mistaken identity with the dog. and the chief thought it was very funny, you know. And so, you know, we continued hunting, and there were times on that hunt where there's no question. You know, when you work out with a personal trainer, the personal trainer can always push you a little further than you can push yourself. Well, yeah. I was being pushed further than any personal trainer could ever have pushed me, because my life was on the line. If I got stranded out there, I'm in the middle of Africa. I do not have a weapon. There are wild animals. And I found myself in this deep meditative zone. And this is the big observation I made. And it maybe it took 10 years of visits, or maybe it just took this one event, but that is this. every single thing that the Bushmen do, every single thing that the Hadza do to pursue pleasure is good for them. Every single thing that they do to pursue pleasure is a survival strategy for them, or it's a propagation strategy. Every single thing they do either improves their chances of survival or helps them to breed. That's it. Everything they do. Now, of course, we've introduced some poisons. They now pursue alcohol, but I'm talking about in their environment. And in other words, in our world, we think of the word hedonism as being a little bit shallow, right? It's like the pursuit of pleasure at any cost, right? You know, oh, he's such a hedonist, doesn't think about anything but pleasure. But you see, for the Hadza people, hedonism is a survival strategy. And that's because their neurotransmitters, their biochemistry evolved for that environment, which means that they are rewarded for doing that which is good in that environment. We have the same neurotransmitters and we have the same general biochemistry. And so now we introduce our biochemistry to Facebook, Instagram, you know, refined sugar and all this stuff. And we're being rewarded for the wrong things. And so, but we keep doing them. That is one of the biggest breakthrough things in my life that I've seen. And it's introduced me to a concept called conscious hedonism, which is recognizing the pursuit of pleasure is the right thing. But you have to recognize that in our world, you can't simply go for the present pleasure because there's a cost. And so we have to have a conscious approach to it.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And yeah, and that kind of makes a lot of sense when you look at it, now that you've said it, because there's this connection then between well-being, purpose, and survival that kind of all loop together for them. But yeah, we've broken that, as you say, because we've put other things in that aren't necessary for our survival or our well-being, but still give us that pleasure. So we need to sort of rewire those for ourselves, I suppose, in some ways, yeah, if we can. But that takes a lot of conscious effort, which not many people...
Here's another example that combines these two ideas, and it's really valuable. So we all know that we're supposed to be exercising. If we don't exercise, then our muscles will atrophy and all that kind of stuff. But here's the thing that most people truly don't know. Like I have these conversations and people are like, what? But you see, we evolved a pump for our cardiovascular system, right? So we have the heart and we have the diaphragm. And the reason we have those pumps is that the circulation of oxygen in our body is important and urgent. It's important and urgent. So we couldn't just wait for it to get there. We had to pump it there. So we evolved a heart, we evolved a diaphragm. But lymph is important, not urgent. Lymph is important, but not urgent. And so here's the issue is, if you live the Hadza lifestyle, your basic daily requirements for food and water require you to move, and muscular contraction and muscular expansion and muscular flexibility drives the flow of lymph around your body. So if you're an average Hadza person, the pump is your lifestyle. Now we have Netflix and we have people sitting on their ass for their job and they're not pumping lymphatic fluid around their system in anything like an efficient manner. And we don't have a pump. And guess what? I would say that that's the root of a huge amount of the infection and inflammation and all the challenges that we're having. And it's simply a matter of our bodies evolved for that lifestyle. And now our bodies are in this lifestyle.
Yeah. And you've been talking, that brings me on to my next thing I wanted to talk to you about. You've been talking a lot about immunity recently. Obviously, it's so relevant over the last, couple of years with everything that's happened. And we've touched on a few, a few of the areas that, you know, feed into our immune systems not being as optimal as they could be. So we've got movement, we've got food, What other things do you try and advocate to people in terms of supporting their immune system?
So I want to offer a disclaimer. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an immunologist. I'm just a guy. Yeah. I'm just a guy with some observations. And so here are some observations. As I understand it, you have we have an acquired immune system and we have an innate immune system. And the acquired immune system is the immune system that we acquire through interaction with pathogens. So, we encounter a virus, our body works to decode that virus and learns to produce proteins that we call antibodies. And those proteins match with that virus. And then our body stores the blueprint of those proteins in case we ever bump into that virus again, the acquired immune system. But we also have the innate immune system, which is the discounted. Nobody's talking about it. You're not even allowed to discuss it on Facebook, because if you even talk about natural immunity, you can get censored on Facebook because you're not allowed to discuss it. But the fact is that the innate immune system is basically your entire body and every cell in it that's constantly trying to keep itself clean and alive. And that is the thing that protects you when you fall. And you coagulate and you scab over, instead of bleeding out, your immune system did that. When you bruise, your immune system did that. And your body's fighting stuff, your immune system did all that long before you had acquired immunity. You have this innate immune function. And so somebody who's, say, currently unvaccinated and has not had COVID, so they clearly have no defense against COVID. The only defense they have is their innate immune system. Okay, so then the question is, can the innate immune system deal with viruses? Well, absolutely it can. In fact, it's the innate immune system that protects you until you acquire the antibodies, like until you figure that piece out. And so that's our shields. And it's important to understand that the way those shields work is that those shields work as long as you are not distracting them. So one thing is if you get a legal summons and you start producing cortisol and adrenaline during that time, you've lowered your shields and you are no longer defending yourself against pathogens. Because just like the Star Trek Enterprise, sometimes you got to divert power from the shields, right? And so the body redirects energy depending on what's the most urgent thing. And so what we want to do is make sure that we are not dealing, like, we never evolved to deal with chronic stress. Chronic stress is fatal to to this day, the lowest ranking members of chimpanzees have the lowest lifespans because they're dealing with chronic stress. We weren't meant to do that because it lowers our shields. So what that says to me is that we should all be thinking incredibly hard about how to A, keep our innate immune system operating optimally, and B, how to stop ourselves from damaging it or turning it off. So we can turn it off by, for example, stressing out about stuff that we shouldn't be stressing out about, or stressing out about it for long term. If you want to stress about something, stress out for half an hour, but then go for a walk and cleanse that shit out, right? Get away. Yeah. But then there's another level to look at. And this is Mona, if you and I were going to get a car and drive, I can't use an example in the UK because there's nowhere to drive that's that far, but let's say it's Canada. We're going to drive from, say Halifax to Vancouver. It's going to take us 5 days of driving.
Yeah.
Well, before we undertake that drive, we're going to do some stuff. We're going to check the car. We're going to check the fluids. We're going to check the gas. We're going to check the oil. We're going to check the tires, the pressure, the treads. You know, there's some basic stuff we're going to do to protect ourselves on the journey. And in a very real sense, this body that you're in right now, this is your car for the journey. It's the only one you get. You can't trade it in. And so we got to take a look. So what are the car's needs? Well, first of all, oxygen. And it's not simply good enough to breathe. It's not simply good enough to breathe. We have to breathe the best quality air we can and understand that there are different methods of breathing. For example, there is stress breathing, or what we call in WildFit, prey breathing. And that's the way a prey animal breathes when it's trying not to get spotted. Shallow, which is the way most people breathe sitting at their desk. They breathe like prey on a constant basis. You know what noisy breathing is? It's predator breathing. And when you breathe like that, you wouldn't breathe like that if you thought you were in danger. You're like, I'm just chilled and I can have long, loud breaths. And your body goes, oh, cool, we must be safe. And so it's not just breathing enough. It's not just breathing good quality, but it's using the right manner of breathing to communicate the right things to the body. Then, of course, we have to be hydrated. And you can't, if you're thirsty, it's too late. You have to drink preemptively. You're drinking on Monday to not be dehydrated on Thursday. And so we have to stay hydrated. And then, movement is very important, as we've already talked about. Sunlight. Like, I want to be really clear about this. The sun did not suddenly become evil in 1962 and start giving everybody skin cancer. Don't get me wrong. I fully understand. In fact, this is another example of the evolution gap. People who evolved on the equatorial belt have the darkest skin in the world. And as their ancestors moved north or south, their skin got lighter and lighter and lighter. So, you know, then now the evolution gap is you take somebody from Europe and you put them on a jet plane and move them to Australia. They evolved for 3 months of sun. So they evolved very light skin and light hair so they could let more sun get in to help them stimulate more vitamin D. Then you move to Australia where they have 9 months of sun. Guess what? Bad news, right? They need to be avoiding it. But at the same time, we've now gotten to the point where we're so paranoid about the sun that there are people who are lathering themselves in cancer-causing chemicals. There was a big story on the news just a few days ago about this, you know, and they're lathering themselves in these chemicals that are blocking their skin's ability to breathe. And they're denying themselves all sunlight, which is just as dangerous as too much sunlight. So we got to get our sun. And what else? We talked about movement, nutrients. Like we got to put in, I'm talking about non-energy nutrients here, the right vitamins and amino acids. When somebody, for example, chooses to avoid an entire food macro, I'm not naming names here at the moment, but you think you know where I'm going, is that you're not getting all the amino acids you need. You know what? Amino acids, that's the way I like to describe them to people, is that there are, I think, 21 of them that you need. 9 of them are essential. You can't make them. And they're like Lego pieces. Your body uses them to build all the complex proteins in your body. Well, if you're missing a bunch of those, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah,
particularly when you think an antibody is a protein. If you can't build that protein, you can't build the antibody.
Yeah. So it's one of the things I think people are often most surprised about when I talk about the importance of protein and the immune system, because we need the protein, we need the amino acids. They're the building blocks of the antibodies. They're really important. That's just one small facet of what they do in our bodies. But that's one that really surprises people.
It's the same even with sugar management. Like, Here's the fact of the day that a good 60% of people listening to this will probably go, no. Protein, basically, you know this, like proteins are just complex molecules that our body builds to do certain jobs. But insulin is a protein. Insulin is a protein. Like, it is so important that we are well nourished and that we are topped up on not just protein, but the full suite of amino acids in whole proteins. So getting our nutritional needs met are really important. So like we said, air, water, sunlight, movement. But there's another one that's really important, and that's been particularly tough the last 2 years, and that is physical contact.
Yeah.
It is really important. Like, in fact, I started talking about this a year ago, and I think it's starting to show up in the news. You'll start seeing more and more of it. But I believe you're going to see credible science that's going to demonstrate that the children that are now like 5 and 6 and 7 years old, that sure they get whether they get vaccinated or not, that's another debate. But what we're going to find is that they are far more susceptible to colds and flus and respiratory disease than the last group of children were. And that's because the immune system gets stronger through use. By isolating everybody, people's immune system did not get stronger over the last 2 years. It got weaker because they were so isolated. So it's really important that we get physical contact and hugs and cuddles and handholding and all that stuff that's important to our health and our stress and our immune system.
Yeah. And as you just mentioned there, physical connection reduces our cortisol levels as well. So that supports the immune system in a different way. You know, there's actually so many elements to that. And it supports brain health and good connections within the brain, you know, so many things. So, I really like that. And we've come to the end of our time. I think that was a lovely place to end, actually. And thank you.
You're very welcome, Isabel.
Thank you so much for listening today. And I really hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Do follow me on Instagram at @thehealthspandoctor for information on the show, as well as recipes and health and nutrition advice. Until next week, let's live life better.